has been a part of Henk Steffbergen's family for almost 400 years. He travels the world both selling and educating the public about the best uses and care for Dutch bulbs. He was recently in Utah for the Tulip Festival at Thanksgiving Point, and I had a chance to speak with him after his return to Holland.
How does one get started in the bulb business?
Well, you inherit that. Your parents are in the business, your family's in the business, I like the flower bulbs, and then you roll into it automatic. My uncles were in the export to Sweden and Scandinavian, so yeah, you pick it up automatic.
So how long has it been in your family?
We found the first papers in 1527, when the first one of my ancestors bought a piece of land with the name Stuyvenbergen. And Stuyvenbergen means blowing sand, so dunes formed by blowing sand. That's what it means.
And as far as growing bulbs in Holland, why Holland? Why is it such a perfect environment for producing good bulbs?
It is not only Holland, but it's the most common place you think of flower bulbs. But the climate is so perfect, right on the coast. You have very mild winters, very mild summers. That means kind of warm winters and cool summers.
So is that one of the things for bulbs then? They like to have a little more mild winter and not so hot of a summer?
That's true. You can see it in some areas where the tulips are burning as soon as it's getting over 35 degrees.
I know here in Utah, we do tend to get quite cold in the winter, so we get the required chilling hours that bulbs need. But I know, I'm guessing in southern Utah, in the St. George area, where it gets to 110, 115, that bulbs would not do so well?
No, that's correct, because they need a cooling time for about 14 weeks below 48 degrees, and this is to form the starch into sugar, and that makes the tulip grow. They need a cool period.
Well, let me ask you about the bulb history, and especially with tulips. I found some of the information that I found somewhat fascinating, but your family's been in the business a long time. Why did tulips eventually make their way to Holland in the first place?
Holland used to be in the center of the whole world. It was a powerhouse. We had so many colonies, so Holland was the center. So every botanist wanted to be in Holland or in Western Europe. And Holland was lucky enough to have one of the people at the embassy in Vienna. They found some tulips, and there was a botanist from Sweden, and he got hired by the University of Leiden. And he had a few tulips in his collection, and he took them with him at the end of the 1600s. Around 1595, he took them all back to Leiden, and that's where he put them in the botanical gardens of the university. And in a few years, it became a commodity to have tulips. If you had tulips, you were a rich man. In some cases, it is known that people were selling the whole farm just to buy two or three tulips, and that caused just the first stock crash in the whole world. In 1634, people were buying a tulip for about $1.5 million at the moment, compared to the 2013 prices.
So in today's dollars, that's how much it would have been back then?
In today's dollars, $1.5 million for one tulip.
Wow. I noticed one story that you had sent back to me that one gentleman had purchased his house he bought it for three tulips?
Yeah. And after the summer of 1636, they found out there was no community to it. So the whole price of all the bulbs collapsed, and people were suicide, and that was the whole fortune.
Was this only just a short amount of time, like 5 to 10 years or so?
Yeah, within 2-3 years even.
Okay. And tell me where tulips originated.
The tulips are original from Central Asia, East Turkey. That's where they still grow wild. Those tulips can be still found in Holland, too. We call them the species, because the tulips still exist in the wild area, too.
Can you grow a species tulips in the same area that you would grow regular tulips?
Yeah, you can. And species tulips are still the best tulips for your climate, too, in Utah, because they come back every year without any maintenance.
Well, now, there's a question that I have in my mind. I've noticed that certain tulips tend to stick around longer than others. Can you address that issue? Why do tulips not last as long? I know sometimes they're just not in the right location, or maybe they don't get the correct amount of water. But for instance, I planted a tulip about 10 of them back in 2001. It was called a millennial tulip, developed for around the millennium. This beautiful, tall, white tulip streaked with red, and it pretty well lasted until about 2 years ago, and then I noticed it was starting to die out. Why does a tulip not continue to last?
Because in Holland, we grow the tulips for their bulbs, so we cut off the flowers the third day they're blooming, fourth day. United States, you want to keep the flower blooming because that's the purpose why you buy it. And what I recommend most people is when it's done blooming, you pinch the seed box off right under the flower. And all the nutrition will go back into the tulip. And if you plant the tulips in combination with some perennials, where the perennials will take over the ugly looking foliage, you will have pleasure for life to go.
Okay, so if you don't pinch those back, then it uses the energy to continue producing the seed?
Yeah, and a plant always wants to survive two ways. If you eliminate the seed, it goes back to the bulbs, all the nutrition, and it will survive that way.
So just as soon as it has quit blooming, and it's, you see the blossom beginning to die, that's when you should cut out the bloom stalk?
Yeah, don't cut the foliage off, just under the flower.
Oh, don't cut the stalk, only the flower?
Only the flower, yeah.
Oh, okay. How long would you then leave on the foliage?
The foliage will die automatic, and then the end of May, early middle of June, the foliage will be brown and dead, and you can take it off.
So is that foliage then putting energy back into the bulb, and so that's why it should be left on?
Yeah, that's true. And if you put some perennials on top of it or some cover, then the ground will be not as hot in the summer, and that caused also the flower to quit blooming over the years, the warm summers in Utah.
I know someone who digs his tulips up every year and replants with bulb food, and to me that's a lot of work, but I guess it makes your tulips last longer if you do it that way?
Yeah, you're correct. Tulips will last longer.
Well, I wanted to look at all of the different kinds of tulips that are now available. It seemed like when I was quite young, I mean, there were different colors, but not the different the different looks, like the parrot tulips or the different sizes and different shapes. Tell me about the hybridization of tulips and how that came about.
Well, if we start looking for a new variety, it takes about, with the tulips, it takes about 7 years, 5 to 7 years to have the tulips in bloom from seed. And if you have about one plot, that gives you about 4,000 or 5,000 different tulips. And then you start selecting tulips. You look at how they're looking. Is it strong? Is the color different? The shape different? And from those 5,000, maybe you got one or two left after 25 years. And then it is ready for the commercial market.
Sounds like you need a lot of space in order to grow commercially tulips.
You do. You do. In all, the total acreage is about 25,000 acres of tulips. And you're looking at about 18,000 acreage of daffodils, and then hyacinths about 10,000.
Financially, where is the money in bulbs? Is it in the tulips? Is it in daffodils, in the hyacinths? What does better?
The tulips do better than daffodils.
And I've noticed in the last even 10, 15 years some really spectacular new daffodil varieties.
Yes, that's true. Some are coming, but the most daffodils are coming from England because the climate is better there.
How is it different where they're grown?
They grow more inland. I don't know why. It has to be with the soil, and they grow nicer and rounder, firmer in England.
Well, I know around here where we have a lot of deer, people try to plant tulips with their daffodils, but the deer seem to be able to find the tulips anyway. Do you have any suggestions of how to keep the deer out of your tulips?
What we always recommend is deer off.
And is that
E-E-R-O-F-F. And when you buy your tulips and you start planting them, you make a solution of all the deer off, and you dip your bulbs in there. Then you plant the tulips, and you still store the solution of your deer off. And as soon as the tulips emerge from the ground, you spray them every week. And that odor keeps the deer away. And works. But this quite a bit work, I have to admit.
Yes, especially if you have a lot of tulips.
Yes, and when it rains, you have to apply it again because the rain will wash it off. And
Can you address any tulip diseases or viruses, or do they tend to be pretty clean from that?
Tulips pretend to be pretty clean, yeah.
Now, I know
you buy a healthy bulb in the store to start with, and big one. The bigger the bulb you buy, 12 up, the better the bigger the flower is, and the longer they will bloom.
So 12 centimeters?
Yeah.
Or larger?
There's 12 centimeters around. That's about 5 inches.
And in the average garden, how long do you think that 12-centimeter bulb will last if it's taken care of correctly?
I think for a good, healthy look, it takes about 4 to 5 years if you take care of it. If you don't take care of it, it takes about 2 or 3 years, and there will be corn.
So now this leads me into another question. I've noticed that some tulips tend to revert back to their root color, whether it's just yellow or red, but then others, they don't. They're just fine. Like the millennial tulip that I was telling you about, it's never changed. And I thought, well, maybe it's because I didn't have it next to one that was more aggressive and it would take it over.
Now, for example, if you have tulips that are bred by seed, they never go back, they never change colors. But if you have tulips that are mutation, that means if I walk in a field with yellow Monte Carlos, they found it a red tulip and they named that Ebba, like the Swedish song group.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes if you have a whole field of red Ebbas, you can see they go back to the yellow. If a tulip is coming from a mutation, the new variety, it can go back to the old color. And if it is bred by seed, it never goes back.
What percentage of tulips are done by seed versus mutation?
I think 90% by seed and 10% by mutations.
Okay.
New varieties.
Are there any varieties that tend to be more aggressive than others and might just... I know I grow a lot of iris, and I know that I have some iris varieties that just grow a lot better and that they could take over other varieties and keep them from growing eventually if I did let them.
Yeah, Darwin hybrids are the best performers, in my opinion, always. They give you a bigger flower, and they grow easier. But they're harder to find because the most breeders in Holland are looking for good tulips because that's far away the biggest market for greenhouse production. And they need a triumph tulip, and they're better for good flower production.
So it's harder to find hybrids?
The market is not there. The big market in Holland and in the world is for good flowers, for good tulips. So if you want to have new variety, you make more money if it's good for cut flower production.
And you're not as worried about having them go back to the original color if you're just growing them for cut.
Yeah, that's true.
Okay. What, as far as when you're planting tulips, can you naturalize them? Do they do well that way?
Yeah, you can. Like I said, if you Google on Cornell and flower bulbs, there is a list that says naturalizing tulips, which are the best. And that list is done by Cornell University, and also they make a combo with perennials. So they naturalize. Some of them are blooming for 10 years already.
And would species tulips work well for that?
Yeah, species tulips are still the best. I sell to a park in Dallas, and I see the Cusiana species, peppermint stick, coming back for 25 years already.
See, that sounds like the tulip for me, because I'm a kind of a lazy gardener sometimes, and I'd rather plant and not have to worry too much about them.
Well, you should work more in your garden.
I have too much
People
garden, I think.
People spend a fortune on the workout shops, and now they can work in the yard for free.
Well, okay, so tell me, is there anything that you can plant? You know, the tulip's been in your yard for a year. Is there anything that you can add on top of the soil? I know bone meal does not travel through the soil, so you'd have to dig up a tulip to get it into the bone meal, but is there anything else that you can put on the tulip to help it grow better?
What I always recommend is some dry cow manure.
Okay. And just work it into the soil?
And work it in the soil, and that gets down automatic to the bulb. It's still the best.
Well, there's lots of dry cow manure around Cache Valley, I'll tell you that.
I know.
Now, you were recently in Utah, and were at Thanksgiving Point. Do you want to discuss what you were doing in Utah?
I'm a sales rep for the family in Utah and Colorado, and I do sell to the Thanksgiving Point. And I was last Saturday. I was there from 10 to 12, and was answering all the questions from the people. And there were many people there.
And they have a tulip festival there each year.
Yeah, real nice.
Why don't you discuss a few of your clients and the people and the royalty that your family has serviced over the years? Where would we find your tulips?
You can find them at the local garden centers, like Anderson.
Mm-hmm. But what about across the world? If I went to the Vatican, would I see tulips?
What we do for the Vatican is we supply the bulbs for one of the forcing people here in Holland. And when Easter comes around, all the tulips at the St. Peter Square are coming from our warehouse every year.
That's quite an honor. And you also serve kings and queens?
For the Queen of Holland, we do ship the tulips to Canada because one of the princesses was born during the Second World War. And to remain a princess, they had to declare the Canadian soil Dutch, otherwise she couldn't become a queen in the future. So as a thank you, the queen decided to send every year 20,000 tulips.
So what is it that keeps royalty and governments coming back to your company? What do you do to make sure that you keep that same standard?
By supplying the true-to-name tulips, good quality, and good service.
And I have just a couple of questions left. So we've talked about how long tulips will live, what kind of weather that they grow in, and can you divide them yourself naturally? I know sometimes you get the little bulblets that come up on the side. Can you use those, or is it as old as the parent?
No. If you look real well, if you plant a tulip and you harvest it, you see about one big bulb and about two or three small bulbs around it.
Mm-hmm.
Those are complete new bulbs because the old skin you peel off, that's the old bulb. Prior to planting a tulip in October, if you cut it, you can see the new bulb sitting already. And they're going to empty, suck up the whole old bulb.
Okay, so they won't be as old genetically as the parent. You can plant that new one and have that produce a flower in 4 to 5 years?
Probably in 2 years.
Oh, okay, so a little bit quicker.
Yeah, yeah. In Holland, if we plant about 10 pounds on an area, we harvest about 25 to 30 pounds. And that means if you plant the small seedling bulbs, they grow bigger, and then the third year they bloom always.
And what are the best arrangements that you like to see tulips? How do they tend to look the best?
I like to see them in groups of about 10 to 15 pieces.
And do you like the same color or a mixture of like lighter or darker?
I'm a kind of old-fashioned. I like to see the same color, but I also enjoy the mixes, they see at the Thanksgiving's Point and the Temple Crowns. Yeah.
I bought a couple of colors a couple of years ago. One was just a white with a fringe on the top, and the other was a peach, and had those mixed together, and it's just so beautiful. And tulips, you can get to bloom over about 6 week time period, depending, you know, from early to late season or even longer.
Also, that depends on the season. Like this year, it will be very short season, 4 weeks. The normal season in the normal weather in Utah takes about 6 weeks, yeah.
Okay.
Time frame.
One last question I had for you is if you could have your choice of doing anything in life, would you change what you're doing now?
No.
Why?
I got to travel. I got to meet nice people. And I like flower bulbs.
And you get to do what you love.
Yeah.
Okay. Thank you very much for joining us.
Okay, Brian. And then I got one more request.
Yes.
As an industry, we are making promotion to the United States for people to plant flower bulbs.
Mm-hmm.
And there is a big campaign going on, and that's named DickDropDone.com.
Oh, yes. I've linked to it from my website.
Okay, most people are not aware of that, and that's why I like to bring attention to it.
Oh, no, I love it because it gives very basic information. I discovered it, I think it was about 2 years ago, and I was just looking for information on bulbs, and I thought, dig, drop, done. This looks pretty good. So I put a link to it on my website.
Okay,
so,
I'm glad to hear that.
So, yeah, it's a great website, so thank you very much. And thank you for joining me this morning. I appreciate you taking the time.
Well, it was more than a pleasure.
Henk Stiftbergen's family has been in the Dutch bulb business for almost 500 years, and he spoke with me recently from his
home in Holland.
Use water wisely in your landscape to save you time, improve plant health, and reduce your water bill. Hi, I'm Melinda Myers, horticulturist and gardening expert. Water when the top few inches of soil are crumbly and slightly moist. Then thoroughly moisten the top 6 inches of soil. Apply an inch of water for clay soil and a half an inch to thoroughly moisten sandy soils. Use a straight-sided can to measure the water applied. Make note of pressure and time use so you know what to do next time. Water in the morning whenever possible. Less water will be lost to evaporation, and you reduce the risk of disease caused by wet foliage at night. Use less water by applying it right to the soil with soaker hoses or drip irrigation. Use a watering wand, aqua cone watering device, or gallon milk jug with holes in the bottom to apply water slowly to individual plants. Check containers daily and water when the potting mix is moist as a damp sponge. Water thoroughly so excess runs out the drainage holes. And check out our website for this and other gardening tips.
Programming on Utah Public Radio is made possible in part by our members and Mountain West Bank, a community bank offering a variety of services and summer loan options for consumers at 110 South Main in Brigham City. Information is at mountainwestbank.com. It's a division of Glacier Bank.
Welcome back to the second half of the Zesty Garden. I wanted to get our gardening calendar in quickly before we move on. The first thing that I have on the list is for this Saturday from 10 to 11 at the Tahnaquint Nature Center in St. George. There's a workshop that features everything you wanted to know about herbs, including selecting, growing, culinary use, and preserving. And it's at the Tahnaquint Nature Center, 1851 South Dixie Drive in St. George. And then on May 23rd, so a week from today, and then also May 30th from 6:30 to 8:30 p.m., there is a Gardening in Containers class. It's at Red Butte Garden in Salt Lake. Learn how to create a soothing outdoor retreat by adding containers filled with flowering plants. Examine container design and selection, how to combine plants for aesthetic arrangements, and plant selection and maintenance. Registration is required. Information is at redbuttegarden.org. And then this coming Monday from 6:30 to 8 o'clock at the Ogden Botanical Gardens, their theme this year is Shore to Shore, encompasses shorebirds of the West. Activities will include looking at basic identification and anatomy for all ages, as well as spending time walking the trails around the system of ponds found at the wetland discovery point. Registration is required at ogdenbotanicalgardens.org. And then Wasatch Community Gardens in Salt Lake is hosting a composting workshop. It's Saturday, June 1st from 1 to 3 p.m. Learn what to use and not to use, how to layer, turn, water, and how to build a compost bin in your own backyard. Registration is required. For more information, visit their website at wasatchgardens.org. And last item on my list is there's WaterWise Plant Selection and Garden Tour at the Iron County Visitor Center, 581 North Main and Cedar. It's Thursday, June 13th, 6 to 8 p.m. Learn how to select and properly plant the right plants for your landscape. Explore the variety of plants that will perform well in your landscape and save you water. It's a free workshop, but participants must register by calling 435-586-8132. I have with me in studio for the rest of the hour, Kelly Cope. Kelly, thanks for coming back in.
Thanks for having me, Brian.
Now, we just barely got started in a conversation about growing and looking at cold weather grasses.
Mm-hmm.
Now, your title is Water Conservation and Turf Grass Specialist.
That's right.
So why don't you, I mean, they go together, but tell me, you're not just turf grass.
No, that's very true. And actually, sometimes people say, how on earth can those two things go together? Because turf sometimes has a reputation of being a higher water-using plant, perhaps maybe not the best use of our water resources in the state of Utah. But to me, those two things do go very well together because we can achieve a lot of water conservation if we're efficient in how we manage and irrigate turf grasses. So, yes, I do a lot with turf grasses, lawns, things like that. But a big part of what I do has to do with irrigation efficiency in landscapes. So new technologies, methods of irrigation, scheduling irrigation, things like that.
So in Utah, we're the second driest state
mm-hmm.
in the country.
Yes.
And but our per capita use of water is, I'm not sure where it is, but I know it's pretty high.
Right. And I haven't, you know, that has, it changes depending on the year, but we're definitely in the top five in the nation in terms of our per capita water use per day. And I think the thing that a lot of folks don't realize is that at least on a municipal level, most of that water, and I mean 70 to 75% of that per capita water use per person annually, goes to irrigate outdoor landscapes. And so, in fact, my position was created to help folks perhaps get that a little bit lower and certainly reduce our water use in the state.
So what haven't we quite grasped in Utah that other drier states like Arizona, for instance, their water usage, they're a really dry state, their water usage is less than ours.
Is it
just because it's so hot that they can't grow Kentucky bluegrass, otherwise it just look terrible all the time?
Well, in fact, yes, Kentucky bluegrass would not be an appropriate species for most parts of Arizona because of the temperatures. I think in Utah, people... The will is there. Let me say it this way. People have good intentions, but they don't necessarily know how much it is they're irrigating. So a lot of what I do is try to get that one statistic out there, that 70 to 75% of per capita use, and let people know that that's the amount of water in a given year that they are usually putting on their landscapes. That's the first thing. But the other thing that... USU is very involved with is a landscape irrigation auditing program along the Wasatch Front. And that's part of the Slow the Flow campaign. That's a statewide campaign that we cooperate with a lot of the water districts in the state on. And we actually will send folks out to individual residences as well as commercial landscapes and institutional landscapes to evaluate irrigation systems. And the first step, as I see it, is getting people to... understand how much water their sprinkler systems actually put out over a given period of time. Because when people ask me about irrigating, the first thing they say is, how many minutes should I irrigate? Right?
Well, yeah,
right. And that's not the question to ask, really. The question to ask is, how much water is my system putting out, and how does that relate to what the plants actually need? So as part of our Slow the Flow auditing program, we do that for folks. We determine how much water their sprinkler systems put out, and then we give them a customized irrigation schedule based on that number.
Do you look at soil type as well?
Absolutely.
Because if it's more gravelly or more sandy, you're certainly going to be using a lot more water.
Right. We look at soil type. We look at plant material. We look at the depth of roots and the efficiency of the sprinklers as they are. We recommend fixes, things like fixing tilted and broken heads. Another thing that I find often is that folks don't necessarily watch their sprinkler system in action, so to speak. They don't necessarily see it during its operation. And so as part of our auditing program, we get out there and walk through it with them while it's running, so that they can see where problems might exist. And it's interesting because it's a long-term program at this point. We've been going for almost 14 years, and we've done literally thousands of audits. And what we're finding is that it's the simple fixes, things like straightening out a tilted head or raising a sunken head, that actually make the most difference in terms of system efficiency. And that's a surprise to me. If you'd asked me that question initially, I would have said, well, I think it's probably poor irrigation design, you know, not putting sprinklers in the right spot. But really, it's more these simple little problems that if folks can identify those and fix those and then couple that with an irrigation schedule that's appropriate to their plant material, they can really do a lot to reduce their irrigation water use.
Is there a cost to have one of these audits done?
No, it's absolutely free.
So how does someone get one done?
I will tell you. So it's a very simple process. You can call 1-877-SAVE-H20. You can also go to the Slow the Flow website, and that's slowtheflow.org.
Slowtheflow.org. And is there anything on the extension website?
We don't have it on the extension website because we're promoting it mainly through Slow the Flow.
So 1-877-SAVE-H20.
H20, yeah.
Zero, so the number zero.
That's correct.
Okay.
Yeah.
And then you also said slowtheflow.org.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
And so that's a statewide effort, and the governor's has been instrumental in getting that going.
Well, you can't beat free.
No, you can't beat free. You know, and just... I love the program and I promote the program a lot. But one of the great things about it, in addition to all the irrigation assistance, we do a lot of training with our employees. And so it ends up being almost like a free landscape consultation. I mean, the emphasis is certainly on irrigation, but our folks know a lot about the plant material out there as well. And inevitably, when we do audits, folks say, well, what's going on with this plant? And how come this tree is doing that? And what about that shrub? And so we end up doing sort of a full consultation with the emphasis on irrigation.
So if you don't have an irrigation system in already, mm-hmm. could you have a consultation done that would give you some suggestions?
Well, the program right now is
like
really...
Like my wife, if you came to my house, yeah. the suggestion would probably be get rid of the husband.
Ryan, I'm sure that's not true.
Well, looking at how much I don't take care of my lawn, that could very well be the case.
Well, actually, for our program right now, we really just work with in-ground automated systems. So every now and then we do get a call from somebody who's got either no system. We've had calls from people who are still flood irrigating landscapes, which is still happening here in the state of Utah. Occasionally, we'll get somebody who doesn't have a system yet. And for those folks, we don't usually go to the property, but I will often speak to those folks personally and try to get them some information to help them out and do some planning and suggest some visits perhaps to demonstration gardens, things like that.
Well, my parents still flood irrigate. The whole mm-hmm. back half of their property is garden or grass. Mm-hmm. And if I could get mine in far enough, it's just kind of low enough, I can't quite get it to the backyard, I'd probably flood irrigate it. And the reason why I would do that is the financial incentive. It's still cheap.
Oh, it
so
is.
That's probably one of the reasons, I'm guessing, that
yes.
maybe people don't quite adopt all these certain practices that would make
yes.
for better conservation is the cost.
That's absolutely true. And we didn't mention this when we first started talking about it, but we talked about how dry Utah is and we talked about per capita water use. But in fact, we also have some of the lowest costs for water in the nation as well. So you put all of those things together and it's true. The incentive, at least the financial incentive, is not necessarily there to promote conservation. But the fact of the matter is things are changing. Things are changing. There are enormous water projects underway and planned to continue to supply our growing population in the state, and the costs are going to go up. And that's a factor for sure. But like I said initially, I think people's intentions are good, and I think they want to do the right thing, and I think they want to be efficient. And so I kind of work on it from that standpoint. I certainly don't have any influence over water rates, but I can tell you those are going to be increasing.
So for areas of the state that don't have a water conservation district mm-hmm. like Cache Valley, are those going to become the norm? And there's always a little bit of a pushback because once you get a district set up, it's really hard to get rid of it.
Right. And Cache County, Cache Valley has been reluctant, and I'm a resident here, so, I'm aware of it. We've been reluctant to set something like that up. But to my mind, we may be getting a bit left behind because the larger water districts in the state that have been in place for a very long period of time, they are looking at Bear River water. They are looking at water from this part of the state to, at some point, supply the Wasatch Front. And so we don't at this time really have an agency or a representative or an entity that can get into that discussion directly. And so that's my concern about us not having a water conservancy district at this point. And I don't know what will happen over time with that, but I can tell you I've been in many a meeting and heard about pipelines being planned from this part of the state to the Wasatch Front. So I hope that we can get a voice in that discussion.
Is a district the best way to do it? I think that the main concern is it's set up. It's not. They can pretty much tax and to a certain extent and do what they want. They don't have to have. They're not elected representatives.
That's right. And I understand and share that concern. However, I think simply because of the way it's structured now in the rest of the state and how those decisions are made, I think that really is the most expedient way for us to get involved and have a voice in this conversation. Because right now, the governor's water conservation team, and he does have a water conservation team, is comprised of the heads of all of these water conservancy districts. And they are the folks that he communicates with regularly on what's happening with water supply in the state. And so, again, I think it would be good for us to have a voice at that table.
So right now, at least for Northern Utah, we don't.
We don't. That's right.
Well, you're listening to The Zesty Garden. Kelly Cope is USU's water conservation and turf grass specialist. She's my guest for the rest of the hour. And if you have a question or comment, our toll-free number is 1-800-826-1495. You can also send us your question via email. It's zestygarden@gmail.com. Or you can tweet us a question. It's #ZestyGarden. So if I'm, I am a homeowner that does not have a system put in, what are the best sprinkler heads then that provide the best coverage without throwing it all up in the air and having it evaporate?
Right. That's a big question, but I'll give you a few pointers, a few sort of rules of thumb with landscape irrigation. And I'll emphasize turf because that's where most of the landscape irrigation water does go. Large areas are best irrigated with rotor type sprinklers. So these would have a single stream that rotates in a circle. Then for smaller areas,
So like a Rainbird?
Yeah.
Type?
A Rainbird. Rainbird is a manufacturer, and the terminology gets a little bit tricky here. Rainbird would be a manufacturer with a lot of different types of sprinklers. So,
when I say Rainbird, I'm thinking of the
Yes.
Variety. Okay. So
great impression, by the way.
Okay. Thank you.
Yeah. So that would be, for larger areas, those types of sprinklers are really efficient. So those would be the types you see on parks or university campuses, for example. I was watching some of those on my way in this morning. For smaller landscapes, though, the fixed spray type sprinkler. So you turn that on and it sprays in a circle or a half circle or a quarter circle or some variation on that continually. So those are better in smaller spaces. And then somewhere in the middle, there is a newer type of sprinkler called, and this is a mouthful, multi-stream, multi-trajectory nozzle. And what this looks like, you have almost fingers of spray coming out.
Yes.
Yes. So it's somewhere in between a spray and a rotor. And those nozzles are actually proving to be the most efficient in terms of uniformity of application of sprinklers. And so they can go in smaller areas and a bit larger areas as well. And so they are sort of the third option. And then, of course, for ornamental areas, shrubs, perennials, things like that, drip irrigation is a terrific option.
Or you can pull out all your grass and put in drought-tolerant perennials, and they just use whatever Mother Nature happens to give them.
Or you can change your turf to a native grass and still have a lawn area.
Our producer just said AstroTurf.
No, I'm not a fan. Actually, and it's funny, but one of the great benefits of landscaping in general is the temperature moderation that occurs around structures. And so you don't get that with AstroTurf. You get a lot of reflected radiation and heat. So it's not my first choice.
Well, so what is your first choice?
My first choice, to begin with, any kind of natural landscaping. And I am a fan of turf grasses. I think they can be used very effectively in landscapes. They look terrific. They withstand wear and tear, unlike any other plant material that we utilize. So for areas that are receiving active traffic, yards, places where you have kids, pets, parks, places with a lot of activity, they are really the first and best choice, and they will continue to be the first and best choice. So I see my job as trying to get people to just manage the water a little bit better on those areas so that we can continue to utilize them in the
landscape. So you're probably saying then take a look at how you use your yard.
Absolutely.
And then plan accordingly.
Absolutely. And if you don't have a lot of traffic or need for wear resistance with plant material, take a look at perennials and ground covers and all kinds of other things. I mean, in my own home landscape, I've got some turf, yes, but I've got very, very large beds of ornamentals, so perennials, shrubs, several trees. I mean, trees to me are just should be a priority in the landscape. I just mentioned temperature moderation, and they're one of the biggest factors. If they're planted appropriately in the right spot in a landscape, they can provide shade in the summer. They can provide screen from winter winds in the wintertime. I mean, they can just do terrific things in the landscape. So for me, I prioritize my trees in the landscape. I treat them very well, and I make sure that I get the turf away from their base and get them enough water so they're not in a lot of competition with grass.
So then you're probably also looking at what kind of trees are more native to the area. I'm guessing you don't plant cottonwoods or
no, I don't.
Yeah, yeah.
No, I
mean, they're native. Cottonwoods are native, but they also soak up a ton of water.
That's right. That's right. And I'm not a tree expert, but I do try to have trees that are going to be happy with the water that I think is appropriate.
Okay. Well, we have an email question. It says, so Slow the Flow does not include a water audit for Cache County. Is there any way to get a water audit on Cache County?
Well, that's correct. So we don't have a water district here. We're not cooperating with a water district to provide the program here. But what I can recommend for folks in Cache County, as well as other counties in the state that might not have the program available to them, is to contact their local county extension office. And here that would be in our Cache County building, which is downtown on Main Street.
Right next to the courthouse.
Right next to the courthouse. And folks there can help with providing materials and information to do your own check. And I happen to know we've got a new horticulture person on staff there who could also be helpful.
Who is that?
Her name is Helen Munz.
Oh, okay, great.
Yeah,
I wasn't aware of that. So good for Helen.
Yeah.
So as I'm reading this and hearing you talk, so if I wanted to have someone come out to the home, that's not available in Cache County because we don't have the districts, or you're only working with the districts?
Right. The program, the larger program along the Wasatch Front, we're working with Jordan Valley Water Conservancy District, Metropolitan Water District of Salt Lake and Sandy, as well as Central Utah Water Conservancy District. Now, the three of those cover a huge number of counties, mm-hmm. and so we do cover a very large area. I happen to also know that in St. George area, Washington County Water Conservancy District has a program. Weber Basin Water Conservancy District also has a program, so coming northward along the Wasatch Front. So there are programs in many areas of the state, but like I say, I think for folks that don't have it directly available through our program, they can still get a great amount of assistance from the county extension offices, which do exist in every county. And they haven't been published yet, but I've actually just created a quick fact sheet for every single county in the state that a homeowner could use to do their own water check, their own irrigation system audit.
Okay.
So those will be available shortly.
And through the website?
Mm-hmm, through the extension website.
So extension.usu.edu. And I promote this every single week, but garden.usu.edu is a great resource. And you can find – I just typed in your name in the search engine and came up with a bajillion PDF files and different things to look at just for grass. So it's very helpful.
Good.
So thank you to Kurt in Hyde Park for that question. If you'd like to join our conversation, toll-free number is 1-800-826-1495. Or you can send us an email question, zestygarden@gmail.com. Or you can tweet us your question. It's #zestygarden. Okay. So I want to be able to put in more conservative turf grasses as far as water consumption is concerned. Mm-hmm. So what would you recommend?
Okay.
I've got an old grass that's at my house. It's been there a very long time. And I'm fescues of some variety, I guess, would be part of that combination.
Yeah, yeah. So let's start just with the commonly used turf grass species in Utah. So first and foremost would be Kentucky bluegrass. And it's still a fine choice for many applications. But I do talk a lot about using fescues in the landscape for folks who want to perhaps be a little more conservative with their irrigation. And the fescues could be divided into two sort of categories. There's tall fescue, which actually looks very, very similar to Kentucky bluegrass. And then there are the fine fescues, things like hard fescue, sheep fescue, chewings fescue, which have a narrower blade and a little bit different color, but are really, really tough in terms of withstanding, you know, drought and high temperature conditions. So Those are definitely options. And last time I was in, we also talked a bit about warm season grasses like buffalo grass, which are also fine options for use in Utah and have lower water requirements than some of the other species.
So if you have an established lawn that's been around for a while, is it better to kill it and start over again, or do you try to overseed?
Well, you're going to be most, if you really want to make a big change to a totally different species, you're going to be better off to kill it and start from scratch. On the other hand, you know, I talk a lot with folks who might have certain disease or pest issues. And for those folks, I sometimes recommend overseeding with pest or disease resistant varieties of the turf grasses that are available. So, but if you do, like I said, if you do want to make a big change, a totally different species, perhaps a totally different look, starting from scratch is the best way to go.
Okay. And yeah. Starting from scratch at what time of year is the best way?
Well, spring and fall are the best times for establishing new lawn areas from seed.
So is it getting a little too hot right now?
Yeah, if you're going with cool season grasses, yes. Now, if you were switching to a warm season grass, then it would still be fine to go in that direction right now. Because those grasses, it's just like what they sound like. Warm season grasses, they prefer those warmer temperatures. And so they're going to thrive and do best at this time of the year. So if you were switching to a warm season grass, now would be a great time.
All right. So looking at doing a more cool season grass or a different combination, what percentage if the ideal, I know each ideal is different, but if you're a homeowner that just, you don't really know what to do, mm-hmm. what would you recommend? Because there's been an explosion of different varieties.
Oh yeah, that's, you know, I don't know if people necessarily realize that within just the species of Kentucky bluegrass, there are literally hundreds of varieties out there. I mean, it's very overwhelming. The good news is that here at USU, I have a colleague, Paul Johnson, who is a turf grass geneticist and breeder, and he has done a whole lot of evaluation of all of these different varieties. And so we have an extension fact sheet that's available on the website called Turf Grass Cultivars for Utah. And we have gone through and chosen the varieties within each species that have performed the best here in Utah. And so that's a great place to start. And there's a little bit of information there as well about what these different species look like and how they're best utilized and a little bit about what their requirements are. So folks can have a look at that and see what species they might like and then see what varieties we recommend. And then they can go to a seed supplier, and we have a few listed on the fact sheet as well, and find out what's available. Because so it's funny, we can recommend varieties, but we don't necessarily know what happens in the industry. For example, one time we found out there had been a warehouse fire that had just completely obliterated a variety that we were recommending. So we don't necessarily know about all of those things as they happen, but we try to keep this fact sheet as updated as we can.
Okay, so is this the one?
That's it.
Okay, so I just typed in turf grass cultivars for Utah and did a Google search, and that's what popped up. But I'm sure you could do it at the website as
Absolutely.
Well.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm.
And there's a photo showing a crosshatch and a checkerboard, if you will, of different grasses, and you can really see the difference in
mm-hmm.
color.
Mm-hmm. And that's all one species.
This is all one species?
That's all one species, but just different varieties. So okay. That's why we do the testing. And, you know, by the way, we're really fortunate because there are many, many states in the country that don't participate in this testing like we do. So we're really, really lucky to have that information.
Wow. And so tell me about the typical trial. Are you blending grasses together to see what works the best, or do you do it according to bluegrass, tall fescue, or fine leaf fescue, or whatever?
Well, for this testing program where we determine what varieties we're going to recommend, those are pure stands of the different varieties. So we're not mixing species in that case. Some of the other studies that I have done where I'm really looking at water use and other things like that, I will get locally available sod sometimes or locally available seed and plant those. And so I try to work with what's available to the public now in the state.
So if someone were to go purchase grass seed, is it going to be listed by cultivar or will it be listed by percentage of?
bluegrass versus fescue versus whatever.
Right. What they will typically do is they'll give you the percentage. So how much is bluegrass? How much is tall fescue? How much maybe something else? And they will oftentimes list the varieties as well. Sometimes that's not the case. And it just depends on where you're getting it. You know, sometimes if you go to big box stores, you're going to get something that's very generic and you might not know what varieties are being used. But you know, I'd encourage folks to look at all their options as far as availability, particularly of seed, because seed can be purchased online. It can be purchased from a supply house that may be a little bit further away, but certainly can be mailed to you. And so that's where I encourage folks to start with some understanding of what the different species are useful for, and then take a look at the varieties that we recommend.
So, and the different ways of doing it, of course, you have hydro seeding, you mm-hmm. have plugs, you can get, I can't think of the buy the grass.
Sod?
The sod, thank you. Well, that was hard. And have that put in. The cost is different for each one of those and more
right.
expensive,
right.
I guess, especially for like hydro seeding. But is one a better way to get the grass established than another?
Well, the first thing folks often think about is cost, and seed is certainly the least expensive of all those options. However, you've got to consider what's going to be required to get it established, and oftentimes you'll be dealing with pretty heavy weed pressure for a year or two as you're getting grass established from seed. Sod, you've got instant coverage, and that's great, but it is certainly more expensive. But it's helpful because you don't necessarily have to deal with all that weed pressure. And then hydro seeding, you know, you're somewhere in the middle. One of the benefits of hydro seeding is that there's often some material put out along with the seed to help retain moisture and get it established a little
like
bit better.
Like some polymers or something?
Yeah. And I couldn't tell you exactly what the composition, and it depends on the company, but it's helpful in getting seed established. And so it can be a little bit of a step up from just throwing the seed out there yourself, but you are still going to have some additional weed pressure that you wouldn't necessarily have if you went straight to sod.
And have you seen any new trends in the industry coming out as far as lawn establishment?
Not really.
Those are the basic ones.
Those are the basic ones. But, you know, I think something that folks might be less familiar with, and you mentioned it, is the use of plugs or something called sprigging. And that's both of those practices are used with the warm season grasses. And so plugs, you've actually got a small little plug of soil that includes the grass plant and roots, and those can be planted at regular intervals in a bare area and then allowed to fill in. Sprigs kind of work the same way. It's just that there's no soil associated. They're just plant parts, usually stolons and rhizomes, which are above and below ground stems, but it kind of works the same way. You plant them in a grid pattern over an area, and then they gradually fill in. So that's something that we don't typically do with the cool season grasses. That's more of a practice done with warm season grasses. So folks may be less familiar with it. But if folks are considering a grass like buffalo grass, they might want to purchase it online and purchase plugs or sprigs and then install it themselves.
Okay.
And they can do that.
Kelly, we've reached the end of our time. Thanks for coming in.
My pleasure, Brian.
It goes quickly, and we'll have you back in again.
Sounds good.
You've been listening to The Zesty Garden. My guest in the second half of the program was Kelly Cope. She is USU's Water Conservation and Turf Grass, I can never say that, Turf Grass Specialist.
Very good.
For Utah State University. Thank you for joining us today on The Zesty Garden.
Glad to have you with us. You're listening to Utah Public Radio, a service of Utah State University. This is KUSR HD1 Logan, KUSK HD1 Vernal, KUSL HD1 Richfield, KUST HD1 Moab, and KUSU FM HD1 Logan. Programming on UPR is made possible in part by our members and Mountain West Bank, a community bank offering a variety of services and summer loan options for consumers. At 110 South Main in Brigham City, information is at mountainwest.com. It's a division of Glacier Bank. Programming is also made possible in part by the College of Science at Utah State University, where graduates' acceptance rates to medical, dental, and graduate schools exceed national averages. When students and faculty learn together, discovery follows. Information at usu.edu/science.